This is the new talk, the Bob Davis Podcasts. In podcast 516, get ready, because I think things are going to start moving. We're going to talk about that in podcast 516. Sitting down here in the studio drinking some coffee after an incredible summer storm that we had today. Wasn't so bad in the metro, but, you know, it is summer. And, you know, the basis of this podcast is this sort of beginning of summer energy. And just in terms of meteorology, summer means heat and humidity. It gets hot and then the storms come and it cools off. But the storms bring the high winds, it brings hail, it brings water damage, and storms can do a lot of damage to the exterior of your home. Anybody who owns a home knows it. If you go through neighborhoods, you'll see it. You'll see the sides of houses damaged from hail, and you'll see roofs that have been damaged by hail. And with the storms and the damage will be people knocking at your door who can give you a great deal on storm damage repair. And you may actually, some of these people are so good, you talk to them and halfway through the conversation or even after the conversation's over, you realize you have no idea who these people are. What'll happen is they'll often demand a partial or a full payment up front and then they disappear or they do shoddy work. So a person thinks, if I have storm damage, I have insurance money, you know, my roof's damaged, what am I supposed to do? Well, I'll tell you what you do. You call a name that you know, and I'm going to give you one, and I'm going to give you a number so that you can talk to somebody who is from the area and that isn't going to go anywhere, and that is Cairo Contracting. 612-702-2357. Ed Cairo grew up in St. Paul and Bloomington. They've been around for 15 years. Cairo Contracting is a Better Business Bureau accredited business. So because Ed is a local guy, you know that he's not going anywhere. Cairo Contracting is residential and commercial. They do roofing, siding, gutters, and window repair and installation. And yeah, Cairo Contracting are storm damage specialists. And I've talked about the hail because hail can basically perforate your shingles so that layer by layer they start to deteriorate and you get leaks and you have to get it addressed. So this is another reason to talk to Cairo Contracting. For 15 years, residential and business exterior remodeling experts and storm damage specialists. Cairo Contracting, the name you know when it comes to storm damage repair and exterior remodeling, residential and commercial. 612-702-2357. That's 612-702-2357. Cairo Contracting. And by the way, if you check out that banner at the top of the Bob Davis podcast page, you can see a picture of a house they did in Edina, and their numbers are right there, so you don't necessarily have to rush for the pen while you're listening to the podcast. So yeah, I'm really starting to like this this whole idea of being live from the studio. It all kind of started the way I've been posting the Bob Davis podcast radio show. It's naked. So it just starts out with me talking and I'm live in the studio and then I play excerpts from the show. And I'm starting to really like that, that kind of ambiance. And every now and then around here, you know, this is a busy house. I have neighbors, we're in a duplex and there's always things going on and they are just as nocturnal as I am, which is great. So it's 1 o'clock in the morning and they're doing laundry over there. And I really like that feeling and sound of the dryer and the washer running. It makes me feel like I'm at home. And I could sit and wait for things to quiet down. And then I think, well, you know what? I'll just do the thing live from the studio, which is kind of a joke because of the guy on YouTube that says, you know, here I am in my plane and here I am and this is my house and here's my gym. And, you know, that kind of thing. And then you get to see how rich he is from doing all these things he's been doing. Here I am in my studio in my little house in the suburbs. And I kind of like that ambiance. So that is, that's where we're going to do this podcast for just for fun. Because I just want to get it done because I've delayed this a couple of times. I delayed it actually one day. Usually do a podcast on Tuesday. Last week was crazy. Because I ended up doing a lot more. Then my son came for Father's Day. We did the radio show together. So I pretty much worked 7 days last week. So I'm kind of tired. And so this podcast, I was going to do it yesterday, and then I thought tonight, well, I'll do it today on the deck. And I ended up mowing the lawn instead. And then tonight we had the storm. In the present time, we just had a big storm, and then it was great out there a little earlier, but now it's cooling off. It feels like fall out there. It's weird. We have these storms, and it seems like it cools off a lot colder than either that, or it's a lot more humid or whatever during the day. But anyway, so summer has begun, and it's a beautiful summer so far. I love the full moon, and the longest day of the year was fantastic. And in some ways, in some odd ways, it feels like the beginning of the year, like we've all been asleep all through the year since January. And this is the day that is the wake up. This is the day we run our eyes, we rub our eyes, and then we go make some coffee and kind of slowly start to wake up. And that's the way it feels to me. And it's interesting because suddenly some major stories are starting to coalesce, at least in the mind of the public. We have the British vote to stay or leave the EU on the, I guess it's the 23rd or 24th, so it's Thursday, the 23rd, which is today, the British vote to stay or leave the EU, and its potential to disrupt the economy. We have the plot against Trump by establishment Republicans. So I'm going to talk about those three things, because I think when we get to the end of July, we're going to be surprised at how much things will have moved by then and how much of that is going to be rooted in these three stories. You know, I told you that one of the things I like to do is just pick out a few things that to me appear to be waypoints and tack to those waypoints as a way to tell you what to look for, as opposed to predicting the future, telling people what they should believe or shouldn't believe. Some of this stuff is just feeling. There's a feeling that a lot of this just doesn't seem real, that there is another shoe to drop, and I've had that feeling since the beginning of the year. Even when I was out on the campaign trail, there was a sense of surreality. There was a sense of surreality, a surreal sense that somehow it didn't seem real the whole time that I was out there. And I don't know whether that's because that was really the first time that I encountered that kind of stuff, or whether that it really is surreal, or that we have been living sort of encased in cotton or in some sort of glass box where we just seem somehow disconnected from what's really going on. Now, I don't know if that resonates with you or not, or as some call it, resignates, which don't even get me started because that's not what it is. If this resonates with you, then you'll understand what I'm talking about. If it doesn't, then wait and see if it does at some point. But I think we will be talking about these three big stories a lot after we get rolling in July and August. So the summer has just begun. And as I said, it feels like the beginning of the year. So there's three stories: the British vote to stay or leave the EU, the potential for a leave vote to disrupt the economy, or the potential for the economy to be disrupted anyway, and then the plot against Trump by establishment Republicans. So we're going to talk about those things in this podcast. So first, the Brits. Now, already I've talked about the British vote to stay or leave in the previous podcast with my son. You heard his views as an internationalist and as a international studies major, which is kind of amusing to a certain degree. But efforts to leave the Union are being characterized as the result of a wave of populism sweeping the globe, or alternately, a wave of nationalism or Trumpism circling the globe. And we talked about that a little bit on the previous podcast and to a lesser extent on the radio this last week. And now he listens to a lot of podcasts from the Brookings Institutions in Cato and a lot of these think tanks and a lot of diplomatic stuff and a lot of Politico stuff. And so, you know, I didn't want to argue too much about some of that stuff. But today I did some reading on this stuff and I've come to a different conclusion. And I'll just ask it as a question. What if the discontent concerning the EU is more about regulations and mismanagement than about populism or even nationalism? What if it's more about the failures of government than concern about populism or any of that stuff? Now, populism as a political tactic, and I feel the need to bring this up every single time I do a podcast and use the word populism. There has never really been a populist political party in the United States. There was in the late 1890s. William Jennings Bryan ran on this idea working for, you know, small town America and the common man, because farmers in small town America at the time had different banking needs than the big bankers and the financial services and the industrialists in the big eastern major markets. So now Bryan lost, and the whole thing was this gold standard argument that really provoked populism. That was populism, and since it's been defined as political policy directed toward the quote unquote common man, I don't think what is happening in America is populism. I don't think it's new Jacksonianism. I don't think it's anything other than standard politics in the United States, and I don't think it's nationalism either. Let me just, you know, listening to this thing between the British and the EU and all the stuff going on, one would ask, gee, are there any other countries in Europe that aren't in the EU? Oddly enough, there are, and it's kind of revealing who isn't in the EU. Switzerland isn't in the EU. Neither are Norway, Iceland, Albania, Russia, Turkey, Macedonia, and especially Liechtenstein, and then one other, Montenegro. And most importantly, Switzerland and Liechtenstein are not in the EU. And what do? Among other things, they provide services, banking services. And you add to that the fact that London is the financial capital of Europe. And before you shout elite bankers, Rockefellers and Rothschilds and everything else, let me just say this. Maybe exiting is really about rejecting elite rule than it is about nationalism and populism. The forces that want Britain to stay have pulled out all the stops. I've been reading their arguments tonight. They're throwing in the kitchen sink. It's going to be the end of the world. It's going to cause an international depression. It will shift the power center from Northern Europe to the Mediterranean and Southern European countries like France, Italy, Spain, and Greece. It will cause all sorts of problems if it passes. People will lose faith in government and everything else. First of all, if it passes, Britain will take up to 2 years to negotiate an exit. There will still be trade between the UK and the rest of Europe, as there is now between Europe and Switzerland and Liechtenstein and the US and China and anybody else who isn't in the EU, including Russia and Turkey. We're living, perhaps, at the end of a time in which people have had an almost, I don't even want to say religious, an almost fanatical faith in the power of government to alleviate all that is painful. I think it really comes from the post-war victory haze, and I'm going back to World War II, the idea that government could do no wrong, and not necessarily for the World War II generation, because they certainly had witnessed government doing wrong, you know, from the Depression to getting into the war to begin with and so forth. But I think probably the baby boomers, who saw a world order established by the victory of the United States and the Allied powers at the end of World War II, and government intervention could fix schools, and government intervention could alleviate poverty, and government intervention could promote justice and well-being, and government intervention in terms of trade deals and everything else made the world a better place. And in some cases, it did. But we are beginning to see, and this is only the beginning, I believe, the potential for governments to do great harm, even if it is unintended. Or perhaps we're seeing the dangers of something called unintended consequences. If you go all the way back to the beginning of the American Revolution, the discussion about the errant power of government, the dangers of government power, really was about monarchy, since most of the major, you know, governments in the world, with the exception of the United Provinces, were in fact monarchies. There was no real republican democracy in the world. The only two democracies in the world were the United Provinces, which remained under the power of a monarch, even during that period of time, and later the United States. So monarchs were the conservative power in the world. Revolutionaries wrote and talked about the dangerous power of government, they were talking about monarchs. And I think a lot of people were brought up and were taught that it was the monarchs. It was the unreserved access to power that monarchs had. But today, I think maybe the founders would look on the world's governments and wonder about the capricious nature of government, even if it's unintended, the unintended consequences and the access to unlimited power that even elected leaders have. Does it do harm to the people, even though it might mean well? Well, I think that's an important question. I think that's a key question. I don't think everyone sees things this way yet, and I don't think our politics are not quite there yet. I guess it's a better way to say it is our politics haven't reached the point where we're able to articulate these concerns because we don't speak in those terms in our society in the modern times. And I think part of it is that many people still seek answers from our government. This is one of the reasons why I hesitate to refer to people as Democrats or Republicans. I hesitate to go into the right-left orientation of all political commentators these days because I don't think it really even approaches the way that people are thinking about what is happening. And I guess what I'm saying is most people really just haven't come to grips with what is really going on, which is we have a situation where we really have almost unlimited power when it comes to government. You know, certainly people do have recourse and we do, you know, there one could argue that we have courts and all those things. But one can also argue that there are many, many overreaches of government power, particularly in the EU. You know, we have... it was interesting. I watched this French movie about this guy who got involved with a married woman, and what ended up happening is both the husband of the married woman and the wife of the married man ended up dead. And watching how French law works was really interesting because the accused really doesn't seem to have very many rights. He is put through an inquest and must answer questions, whether he wants to answer them or not. And I thought that was very interesting. So we still have constitutional protections in the United States, as limited as they may be or as feeble as they may be getting these days because of the continued encroaching power of government. So my question about the European thing is it perhaps more laws and more regulations that are creating this concern that the media is talking about when it comes to when it comes to the British exit, calling it populism and calling it xenophobia and calling it nationalism? Is it possible that governments like the EU fail to protect us, to maintain healthy economies, or to take the fruits of our labor from us literally at the point of a gun, or try to control us with surveillance, taxation, more rules and regulations like nudge laws, demands that we do this or that under the penalty of law, and creating this doubt and this idea slowly that people are beginning to wonder, why do we put up with this? And I would just simply ask, why do we? So if you're a business owner, listen up, because I know that you know this is true. I talk about it often. One of the biggest challenges in business is showing how much you appreciate your clients. Now, back when our dads were young, it was easy because everybody was pretty much the same. There was no diversity in terms of the client base. It was, let's go out and have a few cocktails, or let's, you know, go down and have a giant steak at, you know, Charlie's, or let's go to a Naga Hide bar someplace, or let's go on a fishing trip or something like that. And then it kind of evolved in the 80s and 90s to sending these baubles with the company name on it to people. And then for a while, it was all about the boat trip on the lake or the riverboat cruise or something like that. And I'm going to suggest something new because I think it's really cool. It's different. It's social. It's memorable. And it accommodates a diverse client base, which is really the way things are today. And this is an opportunity to get together and socialize and bond with your clients who are in the process of creating something unique at Brush Studio in the West End, St. Louis Park. Here's the deal. Brush Studio events are held in a relaxed and social setting. What happens is an artist guides your team through a featured painting step by step. And it's not paint by numbers. You don't have to have art experience. And what happens is people flip out. They're amazed at what they're able to create. And they hang those paintings on their walls and in their offices and at home. And they never forget that night. And it's really fun. If you want to see it, go to brushstudio.net or click on the banner at the top of the Bob Davis podcast page. They've got video of what these events look like. They're really fun because they're not about painting, but socializing and working together. They've got room for at least 55 people, plus catering from Crave in the West End, so everybody's going to have something good to eat. They've got 22 brands of beer there and an extensive wine collection. A fun, sophisticated way to create a new bonding experience that your clients and you are never going to forget. And you will love them for it, and they will love you for it. So here's what you do. Check out the Brush Studio banner at the top of the Bob Davis podcast page or visit brushstudio.net. You can also reach out to them old school, 952-236-1700. That's 952-236-1700, Brush Studio. So that's kind of one of the things that I looked at. And I guess the point that I'm trying to make is we may not have the language to really address what is actually happening because it's not being reported very well. You know, I see this all over the place. You see Pew does a study and says partisanship is at the highest level that it's ever been. But then you look at how the media covers these stories and the language that they use. And this is why I say that people are using the language from a past age because they really don't have the language to describe the frustration that they have. And that is that we're seeing increasing regulation and increasing control and increasing power and yet increasing failures by our governments to protect us, you know, whether it's the Orlando attack or some other attack or economic failures, when the politicians can't seem to make things work and the technocrats can't seem to make things work, and I'm going to talk about that shortly, people still seek answers from our government, but the answers kind of have to come from us. And I don't think we can provide those answers yet because we don't have the language. We don't have the coverage. We don't have the media because people haven't quite figured out that it isn't more laws. It isn't more sit-ins in Congress and it isn't more rich Hollywood stars to endorse efforts by technocrats to gain more power to solve these problems for us and to ameliorate and solve and salve all wounds and potential threats. I think it's just that the things that the government is doing are slowly beginning to deteriorate. And that's what people are trying to come to grips with. They just don't have the reasons for that. Now, along those lines, one of the reasons that's being offered for voting to stay in the EU for Britain is the possibility that a vote to leave would destabilize the economy. It would be the economic shot heard around the world. You'll even hear end-of-the-world predictors and astrologers talking about the British exit as somehow the trigger for some international financial problem. But is that what is really wrong when it comes to the economy and finance in the world? Every article that I read these days, again, and I've seen this for years, but it's really significant now, states as a matter of fact, it is written so that you will come away with the idea that there is a formula for economic growth that is not being followed. But in fact, it's being followed to the letter. And this is the idea that government monetary intervention is good, that government spending grows the economy, and that stimulating demand will generate growth. This is the Keynesian philosophy that has become something that people take as a matter of faith. Keynesian constructs. But some of us are asking, some people have begun to notice that, hey, we've had 8 years of central bank intervention in the United States and the rest of the world longer, actually, including near zero or less than 0% interest rates, which has negatively affected savings and all sorts of other things. Congress passed a huge stimulus bill. Various other interventions and spending have taken place, whether it's in Japan, in China, in the EU, in the United States. profits still aren't that great. Corporate debt remains high. Sovereign debt remains high. And yet we're not growing fast enough to crater those debts. We're not growing fast enough to create any real inflation. We can't seem to get off the dime economically, not just in the United States, but worldwide. I think international, you know, worldwide economic growth is something like 1.5%, which is not fast enough. So what's the problem here? Is it a situation where we don't have enough intervention? Or I would ask this, is stimulating the demand side while raising taxes to pay for it, increasing regulation, passing laws regarding minimum wage and other regulations, including mandatory paid leave, paying prevailing wage for government projects, nationalized health care of various levels, actually suppressing the supply side, the reason for our work, which is to trade. We start businesses to trade. We start businesses to have individual productivity. We work in businesses, and it's about individual productivity so that businesses can grow and people can make more money and grow markets and find new businesses. We are creating businesses. We're creating customers. We're using tools to grow, whether it's transportation, industry, including technology, or services, including media and banking and finance, and all sorts of things. And a long, long list of suffering suppliers, all of these groups. Maybe what the media sees as, and actually calls, populism and xenophobia and racism and nationalism is in fact voters who don't have the words opposing technocratic elites who seem to have run out of options. The only thing that they know how to do is to continue to stimulate in one form or another, whether it's through central banks or more spending or more regulation or minimum incomes or, you know, you fill in the blank. And the fact is, people can't consume enough information because it's just not simply there. As I said, the stories are all written based on this Keynesian construct that we have to stimulate the demand side and people need to go out and buy things. And what's wrong with Americans? They're not spending. And it goes on and on and on. Well, maybe the problem is that we're not stimulating the right side of the economy. The fact is, we don't have a bunch of good options when it comes to people who are supposedly in control of the government. We don't have candidates who can truly articulate the problem. That's one thing. But it may also be that we really don't understand how to articulate the problem either, because we are also living in this Keynesian construct. Which brings me to the final story that I think we should be watching over the next few weeks, and this is the plot against Trump. Because Trump, who again is called a populist, a fascist, a xenophobe, every word a Jacksonian, Zachary Taylor, you know, I've talked about a lot of it in the podcast, that they've got all kinds of words to describe Trump, but I don't think they describe Trump. But I've been predicting that he would suffer some sort of major attack. I don't mean a physical attack. I mean a political attack by establishment Republicans at the convention. And we are beginning to see this plot emerge. It's quite public, actually. And it's amazing to me to have predicted this and actually seeing it materializing. And I've called it death by a thousand cuts. I am convinced that you're going to see that appear as a headline at some point because the plot is materializing as we speak. Here's how you can tell. Watch who says what and how they say it and where it is reported. And what's the cause of this? Well, I talked about this in the radio show this week, and I talked about it a little bit in the podcast because this has just emerged in terms of something that's of national awareness just today in the fact that Marco Rubio has finally decided to throw his hat back in the ring and run for the Senate in Florida because there's so many vulnerable Senate seats. The RNC is actually most concerned about losing the Senate because if they don't have a majority of establishment Republicans, so to speak, in the Senate, and Trump does become president, then he's going to have carte blanche with a Democrat Senate, and they're worried about that. If it's someone else and there's a Democrat Senate majority, then it's going to make it very difficult for the next president to appoint the right kinds of judges and so forth and so on. This is from Republican eyes, by the way. Because what's happening is you have a number of vulnerable senators for various reasons. John McCain is one of them. Ron Johnson is one of them. Richard Burr is one of them. Rob Portman is one of them. Kelly Ayotte is one of them. I don't know if I pronounced her name right. I don't listen to anything or watch anything. I read it all, so I can't tell you how to I think it's Ayat or Ayet or whatever it is, and I feel like an idiot, but I can't pronounce her name. Anyway, you know, these are senators, and not all of them vulnerable for a specific reason, like they're all moderates. You know, Ron Johnson is hardly a moderate. They're vulnerable for various reasons in their individual states. And the problem is this. I mean, first of all, there's other senators, which I didn't get them all named. But, you know, Mitch McConnell, who's not running for re-election, is very concerned about the GOP losing the Senate, as I said, so much so that they put Rubio back in play. By the way, there may be more to that than meets the eye, because big donors can come in on the sidelines and donate to his Senate campaign. And I don't know what the rules are, but maybe then his campaign could donate to a vice presidential effort. So I don't put it past Marco Rubio to be part of the play against Trump at the convention. So you have that. You have this whole piece about the vulnerable senators. The Republicans are defending more seats this cycle than the Democrats, so that puts the Senate in play. So then it didn't help that Trump has apparently only raised $1.2 million so far. He says he spent $50 million of his own money. There's a lot of fighting right now amongst Republican circles. They were shocked to find out that he'd only raised $1.2 million. He is also grossly understaffed at this point, according to some, to run a national campaign. Some operatives said, I have state Senate candidates who have more in the bank than he does. That is an abysmal amount of money to have in a bank for a national campaign. Now, Trump, for his part, says he can spool it up fast. He can loan his campaign the money. He has the cash to do this. But there are going to be issues with this. Once again, death by a thousand cuts. RNC member Bruce Ash from Arizona says Romney people have been placed on the Rules Committee. That's the source of this conscience clause that everyone's talking about on a first ballot that would free delegates to do whatever. There are people saying if Trump goes to court to try to force delegates to vote the way that they voted on the first ballot because of previous rules, it's going to get thrown out. And then you have Brent Scowcroft, Nicholas Burns, and George W. Bush saying that they will support Clinton over Trump if he is the nominee. You also have Scowcroft today endorsing Clinton. And these are, the State Department calls them realists. They're basically neoconservative. And then the icing on the cake for me, Jeb Bush is reported to be working behind the scenes on the Never Trump or Dump Trump effort at the convention. And there is a load of misinformation coming out. Newt Gingrich said the other day, if you can't vote for Trump, don't come. Don't be a delegate. And then he turns around and talks about democracy and the people voting for Trump. So, I mean, the thing is, my renewed understanding of the delegates, I used to talk about the delegates as basically button men, but in fact, they are representatives. So they kind of come under the same rules. They have a little certificate that says that they're a delegate. They are going to change the rules to allow a challenge. Whether it succeeds or not is anyone's guess. As one operative put it on the establishment side, quote, there will be chaos, but then we'll get something much better. Right? So if they dump Trump, the word presumptive will go down in history as the sign of the biggest blunder yet in the future predicting media. They are like astrologers who are always wrong, saying this is going to happen, that's going to happen, or they always hedge their bets. This one's chart says that he's going to be president, but so does this one's. Isn't that crazy? That was my favorite prediction from astrologers was, well, I'm going to do both charts, and then this woman proceeds to do Donald Trump's chart, and you're listening, and you're going, oh, he's going to win, clearly. And then she does Hillary Clinton's, and you say, oh, you know, how amazing. Both of their charts indicate that they could win. Well, that's completely inconclusive. Well, that's the media constantly saying what's going to happen and who's presumptive and everything else when really nobody knows what's going to happen. Think about it. Even in Minnesota, our Republican committeemen are moderates. And while they talk about unity, that doesn't mean a full-throated endorsement of Trump. And it isn't that he is a weak national candidate, because that remains to be seen. Yeah, the polls say that, but we're, you know, it's very, what have I told you about polls? It's very hard for people to judge an intangible. You can't ask people about an intangible. So until these candidates actually get the endorsements of their parties, the only endorsed candidates are Gary Johnson and William Weld, the Libertarian candidate. So this idea that people can say, I'm going to vote for this guy or I'm going to vote for that guy, or they're high negatives or low negatives, is that you're asking them to rate an intangible. Now, I would be concerned if I was Trump about high negatives, but I don't think that he's a weak national candidate so much. But I think it's that he's a one-man show and that he hasn't closed ranks yet to really help any of the other candidates or Senate candidates in particular. And firing a campaign manager isn't going to do anything, or making an anti-Clinton speech isn't going to do anything, because what makes the world go round when it comes to Washington is money and assisting these guys in filling their war chests so that they can buy TV and internet advertising and run their campaigns in these vulnerable Senate seats. He's not doing that. And they're going to fight like hell to get someone who will do that. And the fact that there's a number of these big donors on the sidelines, and the fact that a number of these donors already said they would start donating to the Rubio campaign in Florida, would really should cause people to say, what's going on here? People say, well, they're not, they've lost. No, the establishment has not lost it. And if you want to know how powerful they are, I still think this is weird. Somehow they got Ted Cruz to quit when all the superdelegates and Democrat power brokers in the world couldn't get Bernie Sanders to quit on the Democrat side. You still have Sanders people out protesting. Where are the Cruz supporters protesting? He is not going to be the candidate. He won't even be on the ticket. You know, so the establishment power brokers in the Republican Party managed to sideline the guy who has over 600 delegates. I mean, Ted Cruz has, a fair amount of popular votes from the primaries, and yet he's been nowhere to be seen. He is basically, absent without leave at this point, although he's in the Senate and everything doing his thing, but he has been out of the media until he came out of hiding sort of to make comments about the Orlando shooting. So I think it's very interesting. And he said he won't be the candidate or even be on the ticket. But it is interesting that he did also have a meeting to try to see if he could restart his presidential campaign. But they got him to quit. Why did he quit? He quit when he could have just kept going. There were only a few more primaries. And I still think that's very unusual. So what's the takeaway? Well, in order to dump Trump, it has to be a centrist unity ticket. So it's Romney or Rubio or Ryan Rubio or Jeb Bush. And I think the next waypoint is going to be who Trump will pick for vice president. This, by the way, according to the establishment, will speak volumes. So I think we'll just have to wait and see. But I think, you know, the whole point of this podcast was to say there's three or four things that you really should keep an eye on. And I think we are going to see things start to move. It feels like we've been in an ice flow, you know, and it's been thawing. And now suddenly the sun has come out and the ice is starting to melt and it's starting to move more quickly. So we'll just have to wait and see what happens in the next few days. I'm not trying to predict the future. I'm trying to give you some things to look at so you can say, I know a few things to watch for. Rather than saying this one's going to do this and that one's going to do that and that one's going to do this. You know, Trump could still be the nominee of the Republican Party and then we'll have another conversation. But we have to wait and see if that's going to happen in the latter part of July. So if anything, if they're going to make a play against Trump at the national convention, things are going to start happening. As far as the Democrat side, it's pretty clear that Hillary has a lock on those superdelegates. So unless Bernie Sanders can do something, or unless she is indicted, or unless somehow some major thing happens and they end up nominating someone else, that's another story. I think I will not use the term presumptive, but she has the best shot at the nomination at this point in time in Democrat circles, even though Democrats do not support Hillary Clinton, and some of them are going to vote for Gary Johnson. Some of them are going to vote for Green Party candidates, and some of them will actually vote for Hillary Clinton. We'll just have to see how that goes, but that's another conversation. I think there are something like 150 to 180,000 private pilots in this country. And most pilots have someone that loves them and they want them to be safe on takeoffs and landings. And most pilots want to get to their location, but they want to get there safely. And a lot of people say, why do you talk about Alpha Systems and this revolutionary angle of attack indicator? Well, because when you turn on final approach, it's great to have a visual indicator of your angle of attack, because this is the most critical time for a lot of pilots. And it can be very unsafe if it isn't done just right. So this is why Alpha Systems AOA saves lives. Click on the Alpha Systems banners for more information about Alpha's revolutionary angle of attack indicator at thebobdavispodcast.com. You can see it on the page. It's the angle of attack indicator. You click on that, there's video, there's content, there's all kinds of things about the FAA-approved Alpha Systems and all the different systems they can put in your plane's dashboard today, and they would like to hook you up. So check out Alpha Systems AOA through the Bob Davis Podcasts by clicking on that banner at the top of the Bob Davis Podcast page. A couple of announcements before I go. First of all, I've got this new thing called the Bob Line Newsletter, which I'm going to do probably sometime in July. And this is going to be a magazine-type newsletter, which is going to come to you via email, but you have to sign up for it through thebobdavispodcast.com. Now, we moved the email sign-up to the top of the page. So if you just simply look down to the right slightly, you're going to see the Bob Line newsletter sign-up. You sign up through that. It takes you to MailChimp. You sign up through MailChimp, so we have your address because we have to have your permission to send you this. And then we've got a system to send this out so it's not 50 million individual emails. Mitch just fixed that so it will work and work great. So it's all set. Some people have already signed up, which is great. And I just want to remind everybody to sign up for the newsletter because it's going to be cool. I might have special offers in there, pictures from Instagram. I'm going to write a little bit about some of the stuff that I talk about, some of the content that makes it into the podcast, some of the content that doesn't, and so forth. So sign up for the newsletter. Thanks for your donations for Mobile Podcast Command at thebobdavispodcast.com. Goes for Komodo Dragon Coffee and beef jerky and diesel fuel and oil changes and so forth. And thank you for listening to the Bob Davis Podcast radio show on the Patriot AM 1280 in Minneapolis and St. Paul, as well as at gcnlive.com and, of course, on the page at thebobdavispodcast.com. And for everybody listening on the old granddaddies of podcast syndication, iTunes, TuneIn, Stitcher.com, BlogTalkRadio.com, and so forth. And then thanks for liking, sharing, favoriting, and following on Facebook and Twitter and Instagram, my favorite social media. I don't engage that much on Facebook or Twitter, but I do love Instagram, and I'm the Bob Davis Podcasts at Instagram. And thanks again for your donations for Mobile Podcast Command at thebobdavispodcast.com. Thanks for listening to Podcast 516. Now we know what to look for in the next few weeks.
Looking, babe, she's looking good now. Hush, baby, 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 baby.